tangled in linens, purple tongue poking from his lips, calling for help that never arrived, melting to a gory pulp in his casket, and then torments in a hell out of Revelation. Cora believed in that part of the holy book, at least. It described the slave plantation in code. "This wasn't harvest on Randall," Cora said. "It was full moon when we picked, but there was always blood."
"You're not on Randall anymore," Royal said. "You're free."
She kept a hold of her temper and whispered, "How so?" "Land is property. Tools is property. Somebody's going to auction the Randall plantation, the slaves too. Relations always coming out when someone dies. I'm still property, even in Indiana."
"He's dead. No cousin is going to bother over getting you back, not like he did," he said. "You're free."
Royal joined the singing to change the subject and to remind her that there were things a body could feel good about. A community that had come together from seeding to harvest to the bee. But the song was a work song Cora knew from the cotton rows, drawing her back to the Randall cruelties and making her heart thud. Connolly used to start the song as a signal to go back to picking after a whipping. How could such a bitter thing become a means of pleasure? Everything on Valentine was the opposite. Work needn't be suffering. It could unite folks. A bright child like Chester might thrive and prosper, as Molly and her friends did. A mother raise her daughter with love and kindness. A beautiful soul like Caesar could be anything he wanted here. All of them could be. Own a spread, be a school teacher, fight for colored rights, even be a poet. In her Georgia misery, she had pictured freedom, and it had not looked like this. Freedom was a community laboring for something lovely and rare. Mingo won. His men chaired him around the piles of naked cobs, hoarse with cheers. Jimmy said he'd never seen a white man work so hard, and Sam beamed with pleasure. Georgina remained unswayed, however. On the day of Sam's departure, Cora embraced him and kissed his whiskered cheek. He said he'd send a note when he settled, wherever that was. They were in the time of short days and long nights. Cora visited the library frequently as the weather turned. She brought Molly when she could coax the girl. They sat next to each other, Cora with a history or a romance, and Molly turning the pages of a fairy tale. A teamster stopped them one day as they were about to enter. "Master said the only thing more dangerous than a nigger with a gun," he told them, "was a nigger with a book." "That must be a big pile of black powder, then." When some of the grateful residents proposed building an addition to Valentine's house for his books, Gloria suggested a separate structure. "That way, anyone with a mind to pick up a book can do so at their leisure." It also gave the family more privacy. They were generous, but there was a limit. They put up the library next to the smokehouse. The room smelled pleasantly of smoke when Cora sat down in one of the big chairs with Valentine's books. Royal said it was the biggest collection of Negro literature this side of Chicago. Cora didn't know if that was true, but she certainly didn't lack for reading material. Apart from the treatises on farming and the cultivation of various crops, there were rows and rows of histories. The ambitions of the Romans and the victories of the Moors, the royal feuds of Europe. Oversized volumes contained maps of lands Cora had never heard of, the outlines of the unconquered world, and the disparate literature of the colored tribes, accounts of African empires, and the miracles of the Egyptian slaves who had erected pyramids. The farm's carpenters were true artisans. They had to be to keep all those books from jumping off the shelves, so many wonders did they contain. Pamphlets of verse by Negro poets, Autobiographies of Colored Orators, Phyllis Wheatley and Jupiter Hammond. There was a man named Benjamin Banneker who composed almanacs. Almanacs! She devoured them all and served as a confidant to Thomas Jefferson, who composed the Declaration. Cora read the accounts of slaves who had been born in chains and learned their letters, of Africans who had been stolen, torn from their homes and families, and described the miseries of their bondage and then their hair-raising escapes. She recognized their stories as her own. They were the stories of all the colored people she had ever known, the stories of black people yet to be born, the foundations of their triumphs. People had put all that down on paper in tiny rooms. Some of them even had dark skin like her. It put her head in a fog each time she opened the door. She'd have to get started if she was going to read them all. Valentine joined her one afternoon. Cora was friendly with Gloria, who called Cora the adventuress, owing to the many complications of her journey, but she hadn't spoken to Gloria's husband beyond greetings. The enormity of her debt was inexpressible, so she avoided him altogether. He regarded the cover of her book, a romance about a Moorish boy who becomes the scourge of the seven seas. The language was simple, and she was making quick work of it.
"I never did read that," Valentine said. "I heard you like to spend time here. You're the one from Georgia?"
She nodded.
"Never been there. The stories are so dismal. I'm liable to lose my temper and make my wife a widow."
Cora returned his smile. He'd been a presence in the summer months, looking after the Indian corn. The field hands knew indigo, tobacco, cotton, of course, but corn was its own beast. He was pleasant and patient in his instructions. With the changing of the season, he was scarce. Feeling poorly, people said. He spent most of his time in the farmhouse, squaring the farm's accounts. He wandered to the shelves of maps. Now that they were in the same room, Cora was compelled to rectify her months of silence. She asked after the preparations for the gathering.
"Yes, that," Valentine said. "Do you think it will happen?"
"It has to," Cora said. The meeting had been postponed twice on account of Lander's speaking engagements. Valentine's kitchen table started the culture of debate on the farm. When Valentine and his friends, and later visiting scholars and noted abolitionists, stayed up past midnight arguing over the colored question. The need for trade schools, colored medical schools, for a voice in Congress, if not a representative, then a strong alliance with liberal-minded whites. How to undo slavery's injury to the mental faculties. So many freedmen continued to be enslaved by the horrors they'd endured. The supper conversations became ritual, outgrowing the house and migrating to the meeting house, whereupon Gloria stopped serving food and drink and let them fend for themselves. Those favoring a more gradual view of colored progress traded barbs with those on a more pressing schedule. When Lander arrived, the most dignified and eloquent colored man any of them had seen, the discussions adopted a more local character. The direction of the nation was one matter, the future of the farm another.
"Mingo promises it will be a memorable occasion," Valentine said, "a spectacle of rhetoric. These days I hope they get the spectacle done early so I can retire at a decent hour."
Worn down by Mingo's lobbying, Valentine had ceded organization of the debate. Mingo had lived on the farm for a long time, and when it came to addressing Lander's appeals, it was good to have a native voice. He was not as accomplished a speaker, but as a former slave, spoke for a large segment of the farm. Mingo had taken advantage of the delay to press for improved relations with the white towns. He swayed a few from Lander's camp, not that it was clear exactly what Lander had in mind. Lander was plain-spoken, but opaque.
What if they decide that we should leave?
Cora was surprised at her difficulty in mustering the words.
They? You're one of us.
Valentine took the chair that Molly favored on her visits. Up close, it was plain the burden of so many souls had exacted its toll. The man was weariness itself.
It may be out of our hands, he said. What we built here, there are too many white people who don't want us to have it. Even if they didn't suspect our alliance with the railroad, look around. If they kill a slave for learning his letters, how do you think they feel about a library? We're in a room brimming with ideas. Too many ideas for a colored man or woman.
Cora had come to cherish the impossible treasures of the Valentine farm so completely that she'd forgotten how impossible they were. The farm and the adjacent ones operated by colored interests were too big, too prosperous. A pocket of blackness in the young state. Valentine's Negro heritage became known years before. Some felt tricked that they'd treated a nigger as an equal, and then to have that uppity nigger shame them with his success. She told Valentine of an incident the previous week when she'd been walking up the road and was almost trampled by a wagon. The driver yelled disgusting epithets as he passed. Cora was not the only victim of abuse. The new arrivals to the nearby towns, the rowdies and low whites, started fights when residents came for supplies. Harassed the young women. Last week a feed store hung a shingle saying whites only, a nightmare reaching up from the south to claim them. Valentine said,
"We have a legal right as American citizens to be here."
But the fugitive slave law was a legal fact as well. Their collaborations with the Underground Railroad complicated things. Slave catchers didn't show their faces often, but it wasn't unheard of. Last spring, two catchers appeared with a warrant to search every house on the farm. Their quarry was long gone, but the reminder of the slave patrols exposed the precarious nature of the residents' lives. One of the cooks urinated in their canteens as they ransacked the cabins.
Indiana was a slave state, Valentine continued. That evil soaks into the soil. Some say it steeps and gets stronger. Maybe this isn't the place. Maybe Gloria and I should have kept going after Virginia.
I feel it when I go to town now, Cora said. See that look in their eyes, I know. It wasn't just Terrence and Connolly and Ridgway she recognized, the savage ones. She'd watched the faces in the park in North Carolina during the daytime and at night when they gathered for atrocities. Round white faces like an endless field of cotton bowls, all the same material. Taking in Cora's downcast expression, Valentine told her,
I'm proud of what we've built here, but we started over once. We can do it again. I have two strong sons to help now, and we'll get a nice sum for the land. Gloria has always wanted to see Oklahoma, although for the life of me, I don't know why. I try to make her happy.
If we stay, Cora said, Mingo wouldn't allow people like me, the runaways. Those with nowhere to go.
Talk is good, Valentine said. Talk clears the air and makes it so you can see what's what. We'll see what the mood of the farm is. It's mine, but it's everybody's too. Yours. I'll abide by the decision of the people.
Cora saw the discussion had depleted him. Why do all this, she asked, for all of us?
I thought you were one of the smart ones, Valentine said. Don't you know? White man ain't going to do it. We have to do it ourselves.
If the farmer had come in for a specific book, he left empty-handed. The wind whistled through the open door, and Cora pulled her shawl tight. If she kept reading, she might start another book by supper time. The final gathering on Valentine Farm took place on a brisk December night. In the years to come, the survivors shared their versions of what happened that evening and why. Until the day she died, Sybil insisted Mingo was the informer. She was an old lady then, living on a Michigan lake with a gang of grandchildren who had to listen to her familiar stories. According to Sybil, Mingo told the constables that the farm harbored fugitives and provided the particulars for a successful ambush. A dramatic raid would put an end to relations with the railroad, the endless stream of needy Negroes, and ensure the longevity of the farm. When asked if he anticipated the violence, she pressed her lips into a line and said no more. Another survivor, Tom, the blacksmith, observed that the law had hunted Lander for months. He was the intended target. Lander's rhetoric inflamed passions. He fomented rebellion. He was too uppity to allow to run free. Tom never learned to read, but liked to show off his volume of Lander's appeal, which the great orator had signed to him. Joan Watson was born on the farm. She was 6 years old that night. In the aftermath of the attack, she wandered the forest for 3 days, chewing acorns, until a wagon train discovered her. When she got older, she described herself as a student of American history, attuned to the inevitable. She said that white towns had simply banded together to rid themselves of the black stronghold in their midst. That is how the European tribes operate, she said. If they can't control it, they destroy it. If anyone on the farm knew what was to come, they gave no sign. Saturday proceeded in lazy calm. Cora spent most of the day in her bedroom with the latest almanac Royal had given her. He'd picked it up in Chicago. He knocked on her door around midnight to give it to her. He knew she was awake. It was late, and she didn't want to disturb Sybil and Molly. Cora took him into her room for the first time. She broke down at the sight of next year's almanac, thick as a book of prayer. Cora had told Royal about the attic days in North Carolina, but seeing the year on the cover, an object conjured from the future, spurred Cora to her own magic. She told him about her childhood on Randall, where she had picked cotton, tugging a sack. About her grandmother, Ajari, who'd been kidnapped from her family in Africa and tilled a small corner of land, the only thing to call her own. Cora spoke of her mother, Mabel, who absconded one day and left her to the inconstant mercy of the world. About Blake and the doghouse, and how she had faced him down with a hatchet. When she told Royal about the night they took her behind the smokehouse, and she apologized to him for letting it happen, he told her to hush. She was the one due an apology for all her hurts, he said. He told her that every one of her enemies, all the masters and overseers of her suffering, would be punished, if not in this world, then the next. For justice may be slow and invisible, but it always renders its true verdict in the end. He folded his body into hers to quiet her shaking and sobs, and they fell asleep like that in the back room of a cabin on the Valentine farm. She didn't believe what he said about justice, but it was nice to hear him say it. Then she woke up the next morning and felt better, and had to admit that she did believe it, maybe just a little. Thinking Cora was laid up with one of her headaches, Sybil brought her some food around noon. She teased Cora about Royal staying the night. She was mending the dress she'd wear to the gathering
When he comes sneaking out of here holding his boots in his hand and looking like a dog that had stolen some scraps. Cora just smiled. Your man ain't the only one come around last night, Sybil said. Lander had returned. That accounted for Sybil's playfulness. Lander impressed her mightily, every one of his visits fortifying her for days after. Those honeyed words of his. Now he had finally come back to Valentine. The gathering would happen to an unknowable outcome. Sybil didn't want to move west and leave her home, which everyone assumed to be Lander's solution. She'd been adamant about staying ever since the talk of resettling started, but she wouldn't abide Mingo's conditions, that they stop providing shelter to those in need. There ain't no place like here, not anywhere. He wants to kill it. Valentine won't let him spoil it, Cora said, though after talking with the man in the library, it seemed he'd already packed up in his mind. We'll see, Sybil said. I may have to give a speech my own self and tell these people what they need to hear. That night, Royal and Cora sat in the front row next to Mingo and his family, the wife and children he had rescued from slavery. His wife, Angela, was silent, as always. To hear her speak, you had to hide under the window of their cabin as she counseled her man in private. Mingo's daughters wore bright blue dresses, their long pigtails entwined with white ribbons. Lander played guessing games with the youngest one as the residents filled the meeting hall. Her name was Amanda. She held a bouquet of cloth flowers. He made a joke about them and they laughed. When Cora caught Lander at a moment such as this, in a brief lapse between performances, he reminded her of Molly. For all his friendly talk, she thought he'd prefer to be home by himself, playing concerts in empty rooms. He had long, dainty fingers. How curious that one who'd never picked a bowl or dug a trench or experienced the cat-o'-nine-tails had come to speak for those who had been defined by those things. He was lean in build, with glowing skin that announced his mixed parentage. She had never seen him rush or hurry. The man moved with exquisite calm, like a leaf drifting on the surface of a pond, making its own way on gentle currents. Then he opened his mouth, and you saw that the forces steering him to your presence were not gentle at all. There were no white visitors this night. Everyone who lived and worked on the farm was in attendance, as well as the families from the neighboring colored farms. Seeing them all in one room, Cora got an idea of how large they were for the first time. There were people she'd never seen before, like the mischievous little boy who winked at her when their eyes met. Strangers, but family. Cousins, but never introduced. She was surrounded by men and women who'd been born in Africa or born in chains, who had freed themselves or escaped, branded, beaten, raped. Now they were here. They were free and black and stewards of their own fates. It made her shiver. Valentine gripped the lectern for support. I didn't grow up the way you did, he said. My mother never feared for my safety. No traitor was going to snatch me in the night and sell me south. The whites saw the color of my skin, and that sufficed to let me be. I told myself I was doing nothing wrong, but I conducted myself in ignorance all my days, until you came here and made a life with us. He left Virginia, he said, to spare his children the ravages of prejudice and its bully partner, violence. But saving two children is not enough when God has gifted you with so much. A woman came to us out of the bitter winter, sick and desperate. We could not save her. Valentine's voice rasped. I neglected my duty. As long as one of our family endured the torments of bondage, I was a free man in name only. I want to express my gratitude to everyone here for helping me to put things right, whether you have been among us for years or just a few hours. You have saved my life.
He faltered. Gloria joined him and gathered his body in hers.
Now, some of our family have things they want to share with you, Valentine said, clearing his throat. I hope you'll listen to them like you listen to me. There's room enough for different notions when it comes to charting our path through the wilderness, when the night is dark and full of treacherous footing.
The farm's patriarch withdrew from the lectern, and Mingo replaced him. Mingo's children trailed him, kissing his hands for good luck before returning to the pews. Mingo opened with the story of his journey, the nights he spent begging the Lord for guidance, the long years it took to purchase his family's freedom.
With my honest labor, one by one, just as you saved yourselves.
He rubbed a knuckle in his eye. Then he changed course.
We accomplished the impossible, Mingo said, but not everyone has the character we do. We're not all going to make it. Some of us are too far gone. Slavery has twisted their minds, an imp filling their minds with foul ideas. They have given themselves over to whiskey and its false comforts, to hopelessness and its constant devils. You've seen these lost ones on the plantations, on the streets of the towns and cities, those who will not, cannot respect themselves. You've seen them here, receiving the gift of this place but unable to fit in. They always disappear in the night because deep in their hearts, they know they are unworthy. It is too late for them.
Some of his cronies in the back of the room amened. There are realities we have to face, Mingo explained. White people aren't going to change overnight. The farm's dreams are worthy and true, but require a gradual approach.
We can't save everyone, and acting as if we can will doom us all. You think the white folks, just a few miles from here, are going to endure our impudence forever? We flaunt their weakness. Harboring runaways, underground railroad agents with guns coming and going, people who are wanted for murder, criminals.
Cora made fists as Mingo's gaze fell on her. The Valentine farm had taken glorious steps into the future, he said. White benefactors supplied school books for their children. Why not ask them to pass the hat for entire schools? And not just one or two, but dozens more. By proving the Negro's thrift and intelligence, Mingo argued, he will enter into American society as a productive member with full rights. Why jeopardize that? We need to slow things down, reach an accommodation with our neighbors, and most of all, stop activities that will force their wrath upon us.
We've built something astounding here, he concluded. But it is a precious thing, and it needs to be protected, nourished, or else it will wither like a rose in a sudden frost.
During the applause, Lander whispered to Mingo's daughter, and they giggled again. She removed one of the cloth flowers from her bouquet and twisted it into the top buttonhole of his green suit. Lander pretended to sniff its fragrance and mock swooned.
It's time, Royal said, as Lander shook Mingo's hand and assumed his place at the lectern.
Royal had spent the day with him, walking the grounds and talking. Royal didn't share what Lander would speak on that night, but he had an optimistic air. Formerly, when the subject of relocating came up, Royal told Cora he favored Canada over the West.
They know how to treat free Negroes there, he said.
And his work with the railroad?
Have to settle down sometime, Royal said. Can't raise a family while running around on railroad errands.
Cora changed the subject when he engaged in such talk. Now she'd see for herself. They'd all see what the man from Boston had in mind.
Brother Mingo made some good points, Lander said. We can't save everyone, but that doesn't mean we can't try. Sometimes a useful delusion is better than a useless truth. Nothing's going to grow in this mean cold, but we can still have flowers. Here's one delusion, that we can escape slavery. We can't. Its scars will never fade. When you saw your mother sold off, your father beaten, your sister abused by some boss or master, did you ever think you would sit here today without chains, without the yoke, among a new family? Everything you ever knew told you that freedom was a trick. Yet here you are. Still we run, tracking by the good full moon to sanctuary. Valentine Farm is a delusion. Who told you the Negro deserved a place of refuge? Who told you that you had that right? Every minute of your life's suffering has argued otherwise. By every fact of history, it can't exist. This place must be a delusion, too. Yet here we are. And America, too, is a delusion, the grandest one of all. The white race believes with all its heart, that it is their right to take the land, to kill Indians, make war, enslave their brothers. This nation shouldn't exist if there is any justice in the world, for its foundations are murder, theft, and cruelty. Yet here we are. I'm supposed to answer Mingo's call for gradual progress, for closing our doors to those in need. I'm supposed to answer those who think this place is too close to the grievous influence of slavery and that we should move west. I don't have an answer for you. I don't know what we should do. The word we, in some ways, the only thing we have in common is the color of our skin. Our ancestors came from all over the African continent. It's quite large. Brother Valentine has the maps of the world in his splendid library. You can look for yourself. They had different ways of subsistence, different customs, spoke 100 different languages. And that great mixture was brought to America in the holds of slave ships, to the north, the south. Their sons and daughters picked tobacco, cultivated cotton, worked on the largest estates and smallest farms. We are craftsmen and midwives and preachers and peddlers. Black hands built the White House, the seat of our nation's government. The word we. We are not one people, but many different people. How can one person speak for this great, beautiful race, which is not one race, but many, with a million desires and hopes and wishes for ourselves and our children? For we are Africans in America, something new in the history of the world, without models for what we will become. Color must suffice. It has brought us to this night, this discussion, and it will take us into the future. All I truly know is that we rise and fall as one. One colored family living next door to one white family. We may not know the way through the forest, but we can pick each other up when we fall, and we will arrive together. When the former residents of the Valentine Farm recalled that moment, when they told strangers and grandchildren of how they used to live and how it came to an end, their voices still trembled years later. In Philadelphia, in San Francisco, in the cow towns and ranches where they eventually made a home, they mourned those who died that day. The air in the room turned prickly, they told their families, quickened by an unseen power. Whether they had been born free or in chains, they inhabited that moment as one. The moment when you aim yourself at the North Star and decide to run. Perhaps they were on the verge of some new order, on the verge of clasping reason to disorder, of putting all the lessons of their history to bear on the future. Or perhaps time, as it will, lent the occasion a gravity that it did not possess, and everything was as Lander insisted. They were deluded. But that didn't mean it wasn't true. The shot hit Lander in the chest. He fell back, dragging down the lectern. Royal was the first one to his feet as he ran to the fallen man. Three bullets bit into his back. He jerked like one of St. Vitus's dancers and dropped. Then came a chorus of rifle fire, screams and broken glass, and a mad scramble overtook the meeting hall. The white men outside whooped and howled over the carnage. Pell-mell, the residents hastened to the exits, squeezing between pews, climbing over them, climbing over one another. Once the main entrance bottlenecked, people crawled over the windowsills. More rifles crackled. Valentine's sons helped their father to the door. To the left of the stage, Gloria crouched over Lander. She saw there was nothing to be done and followed her family out. Cora held Royal's head in her lap, just as she had the afternoon of the picnic. She ran her fingers through his curls and rocked him and wept. Royal smiled through the blood that bubbled on his lips. He told her not to be afraid. The tunnel would save her again.
Go to the house in the woods. You can tell me where it goes.
His body went slack. Two men grabbed her and removed her from Royal's body. It's not safe here, they said. One of them was Oliver Valentine, come back to help others escape the meeting house. He cried and shouted. Cora broke from her rescuers once they got her outside and down the steps. The farm was a commotion. The white posse dragged men and women into the dark, their hideous faces awash with delight. A musket cut down one of Sybil's carpenters. He held a baby in his arms, and they both crashed to the ground. No one knew where best to run, and no reasonable voice could be heard above the clamor. Each person on their own, as they ever had been. Mingo's daughter Amanda shook on her knees, her family absent. Desolate in the dirt, her bouquet had shed its petals. She gripped the naked stems, the iron wires the blacksmith had drawn out on the anvil last week, just for her. The wires cut her palm, she gripped them so tight. More blood in the dirt. As an old woman, she would read about the Great War in Europe and recall this night. She lived on Long Island then, after roaming all over the country, in a small house with a Shinnecock sailor who doted on her to excess. She'd spent time in Louisiana and Virginia, where her father opened colored institutions of learning, and California, a spell in Oklahoma where the Valentines resettled. The conflict in Europe was terrible and violent, she told her sailor, but she took exception to the name. The Great War had always been between the white and the black. It always would be. Cora called for Molly. She didn't see anyone she recognized. Their faces had been transformed by fear. The heat from the fires washed over her. Valentine's house was ablaze. A jar of oil exploded against the second floor, and John and Gloria's bedroom caught. The windows of the library shattered, and Cora saw the books burning on the shelves inside. She made two steps toward it before Ridgway grabbed her. They struggled and his big arms encircled her, her feet kicking against the air like those of one hanging from a tree. Homer was at his side. He was the boy she'd seen in the pews, winking at her. He wore suspenders and a white blouse, looking like the innocent child he would have been in a different world. At the sight of him, Cora added her voice to the chorus of lamentation that echoed across the farm. "There's a tunnel, sir," Homer said. "I heard him say it." Mabel. The first and last thing she gave to her daughter were apologies. Cora slept in her stomach, the size of a fist, when Mabel apologized for what she was bringing her into. Cora slept next to her in the loft 10 years later, when Mabel apologized for making her astray. Cora didn't hear either one. At the first clearing, Mabel found the North Star and reoriented. She gathered herself and resumed her escape through the black water. Kept her eyes forward because when she looked back, she saw the faces of those she left behind. She saw Moses's face. She remembered Moses when he was little, a twitching bundle so frail no one expected him to survive until he was old enough for picking any work, the trash gang or offering a ladle of water in the cotton. Not when most children on Randall died before their first steps. His mother used the witch woman cures, the poultices, and root potions, and sang to him every night, crooning in their cabin. Lullabies and work tunes and her own maternal wishes in sing-song. "Keep the food in your stomach, break the fever, breathe until morning." He outlived most of the boys born that year. Everybody knew it was his mother, Kate, who saved him from affliction and the early winnowing that is every plantation slave's first trial. Mabel remembered when old Randall sold off Kate once her arm went numb and wasn't fit for labor. Moses's first whipping for stealing a potato, and his second whipping for idleness, when Connolly had the boy's wounds washed out with hot pepper until he howled. None of that made Moses mean. It made him silent and strong and fast, faster than any other picker in his gang. He wasn't mean until Connolly made him a boss, the master's eyes and ears over his own kind. That's when he became Moses the monster, Moses who made the other slaves quake, black terror of the rose. When he told her to come to the schoolhouse, she scratched his face and spat at him, and he just smiled and said, "If you're not game, I'll find someone else. How old is your Cora now?" Cora was 8. Mabel didn't fight him after that. He was quick, and he wasn't rough after that first time. Women and animals. "You only have to break them in once," he said. "They stay broke." All those faces, living and dead. Ajari twitching in the cotton, bloody foam on her lips. She saw Polly swinging on a rope. Sweet Polly, who she'd come up with in the quarter, born the same month. Connolly transferred them from the yard to the cotton fields the same day, always in tandem, until Cora lived, but Polly's baby didn't. The young women delivered within 2 weeks of each other, with one baby girl crying when the midwife pulled her out and the other making no sound at all, stillborn and stone. When Polly hung herself in the barn with a loop of hemp, old Jockey said, "You did everything together." Like Mabel was supposed to hang herself now, too. She started to see Cora's face, and she looked away. She ran. Men start off good, and then the world makes them mean. The world is mean from the start and gets meaner every day. It uses you up until you only dream of death. Mabel wasn't going to die on Randall, even if she'd never been a mile away from the grounds in her life. One midnight she decided, up in the sweltering loft, "I am going to survive." And the next midnight, she was in the swamp, tracking after the moon in stolen shoes. She turned her escape over in her head all day. Let no other thought intrude or dissuade. There were islands in the swamp. Follow them to the continent of freedom. She took the vegetables she raised, flint and tinder, a machete. Everything else she left behind.
including her girl. Cora, sleeping back in the cabin she was born in, that Mabel was born in, still a girl, before the worst of it, before she learns the size and heft of a woman's burdens. If Cora's father had lived, would Mabel be here now, tramping through the marsh? Mabel was 14 when Grayson arrived on the southern half, sold down south by a drunken indigo farmer in North Carolina. Tall and black, sweet-tempered with a laughing eye, swaggering even after the hardest toil. They couldn't touch him. She picked him out that first day and decided, him. When he grinned, it was the moon shining down on her, a presence in the sky blessing her. He scooped her up and twirled her when they danced. I'm going to buy our freedom, he said, hay in his hair from where they lay down. Old Randall didn't go in for that, but he'd convince him. Work hard, be the best hand on the plantation. He'd earn his way out of bondage and take her too. She said, you promise? Half believing he could do it. Grayson, the sweet, dead of fever before she knew she carried their child. His name never again crossed her lips. Mabel tripped over a cypress root and went sprawling into the water. She staggered through the reeds to the island ahead and flattened on the ground. Didn't know how long she had been running, panting and tuckered out. She took a turnip from her sack. It was young and tender soft, and she took a bite. The sweetest crop she'd ever raised in Ajari's plot, even with the taste of marsh water. Her mother had left that in her inheritance, at least, a tidy plot to watch over. You're supposed to pass on something useful to your children. The better parts of Ajari never took root in Mabel. Her indomitability, her perseverance. But there was a plot 3 yards square and the hearty stuff that sprouted from it. Her mother had protected it with all her heart, the most valuable land in all of Georgia. She lay on her back and ate another turnip. Without the sound of her splashing and huffing, the noises of the swamp resumed. The spadefoot toads and turtles and slithering creatures, the chattering of black insects. Above, through the leaves and branches of the black water trees, the sky scrolled before her, new constellations wheeling in the darkness as she relaxed. No patrollers, no bosses. No cries of anguish to induct her into another's despair. No cabin walls shuttling her through the night seas like the hold of a slave ship. Sandhill cranes and warblers, otters splashing. On the bed of damp earth, her breathing slowed, and that which separated herself from the swamp disappeared. She was free. This moment. She had to go back. The girl was waiting on her. This would have to do for now. Her hopelessness had gotten the best of her, speaking under her thoughts like a demon. She would keep this moment close, her own treasure. When she found the words to share it with Cora, the girl would understand there was something beyond the plantation, past all that she knew. That one day, if she stayed strong, the girl could have it for herself. The world may be mean, but people don't have to be. Not if they refuse. Mabel picked up her sack and got her bearings. If she kept a good pace, she'd be back well before first light and the earliest risers on the plantation. Her escape had been a preposterous idea, but even a sliver of it amounted to the best adventure of her life. Mabel pulled out another turnip and took a bite. It really was sweet. The snake found her not long into her return. She was wending through a cluster of stiff reeds when she disturbed its rest. The cottonmouth bit her twice, in the calf and deep in the meat of her thigh. No sound but pain. Mabel refused to believe it. It was a water snake. It had to be. Ornery but harmless. When her mouth went minty and her leg tingled, she knew. She made it another mile. She had dropped her sack along the way, lost her course in the black water. She could have made it farther. Working Randall Land had made her strong, strong in body if nothing else. But she stumbled onto a bed of soft moss, and it felt right. She said, "Here." And the swamp swallowed her up. The North. Ran away. From her legal but not rightful master, 15 months past, a slave girl called Cora, of ordinary height and dark brown complexion, has a star-shaped mark on her temple from an injury, possessed of a spirited nature and devious method, possibly answering to the name Bessie. Last seen in Indiana among the outlaws of John Valentine Farm. She has stopped running. Reward remains unclaimed. She was never property. December 23rd. Her point of departure that final voyage on the Underground Railroad was a tiny station beneath an abandoned house, the Ghost Station. Cora led them there after her capture. The posse of bloodthirsty whites still rampaged across the Valentine farm when they left. The gunfire and screams came from farther away, deeper in the property, the newer cabins, the mill, perhaps as far as the Livingston spread, the mayhem encompassing the neighboring farms. The whites meant to rout the entirety of colored settlers. Cora fought and kicked as Ridgway carried her to the wagon. The burning library and farmhouse illuminated the grounds. After a barrage to his face, Homer finally gathered her feet together and they got her inside, chaining her wrists to her old ring in the wagon floor. One of the young white men watching the horses cheered and asked for a turn when they were done. Ridgway clopped him in the face. She relinquished the location to the house in the woods when the slave catcher put his pistol to her eye. Cora lay down on the bench, seized by one of her headaches. How to snuff her thoughts like a candle. Royal and Lander dead. The others who were cut down.
One of the deputies said it reminded him of the old days of proper Indian raids, Ridgway said. Bitter Creek and Blue Falls. I think he was too young to remember that. Maybe his daddy.
He sat in the back with her on the bench opposite, his outfit reduced to the wagon and the two skinny horses that pulled it. The fire danced outside, showing the holes and long tears in the canvas. Ridgway coughed. He had been diminished since Tennessee. The slave catcher was completely gray, unkempt, skin gone sallow. His speech was different, less commanding. Dentures replaced the teeth Cora ruined in their last encounter.
They buried Bozeman in one of the plague cemeteries, he said. He would have been appalled, but he didn't have much of a say. The one bleeding on the floor, that was the uppity bastard who ambushed us, yes? I recognized his spectacles.
Why had she put Royal off for so long? She thought they had time enough. Another thing that might have been, snipped at the roots as if by one of Dr. Stevens's surgical blades. She let the farm convince her the world is other than what it will always be. He must have known she loved him, even if she hadn't told him. He had to. Nightbirds screeched. After a time, Ridgway told her to keep a lookout for the path. Homer slowed the horses. She missed it twice. the fork in the road signaling they'd gone too far. Ridgway slapped her across the face and told her to mind him.
It took me a while to find my footing after Tennessee, he said. You and your friends did me a bad turn. But that's done. You're going home, Cora. At last. Once I get a look-see at the famous Underground Railroad.
He slapped her again. On the next circuit, she found the cottonwoods that marked the turn. Homer lit a lantern and they entered the mournful old house. He had changed out of his costume and back into his black suit and stovepipe hat. Below the cellar, Cora said. Ridgway was wary. He pulled up the door and jumped back, as if a host of black outlaws waited in a trap. The slave catcher handed her a candle and told her to go down first.
Most people think it's a figure of speech, he said. The underground. I always knew better. The secret beneath us the entire time. We'll uncover them all after tonight, every line, every one.
Whatever animals lived in the cellar were quiet this night. Homer checked the corners of the cellar. The boy came up with the spade and gave it to Cora. She held out her chains. Ridgway nodded.
Otherwise, we'll be here all night.
Homer undid the shackles. The white man was giddy, his former authority easing into his voice. In North Carolina, Martin had thought he was on to his father's buried treasure in the mine and discovered a tunnel instead. For the slave catcher, the tunnel was all the gold in the world.
Your master is dead, Ridgway said as Cora dug. I wasn't surprised to hear the news. He had a degenerate nature. I don't know if the current master of Randall will pay your reward. I don't rightly care.
He was surprised at his words.
It wasn't going to be easy. I should have seen that. You're your mother's daughter through and through.
The spade struck the trap door. She cleared out a square. Cora had stopped listening to him, to Homer's unwholesome snickering. She and Royal and Red may have diminished the slave catcher when they last met, but it was Mabel who first laid him low. It flowed from her mother, his mania over their family. If not for her, the slave catcher wouldn't have obsessed so over Cora's capture. The one who escaped. After all it cost her, Cora didn't know if it made her proud or more spiteful toward the woman. This time Homer lifted the trap door. The moldy smell gusted up.
This is it? Ridgway asked.
Yes, sir, Homer said.
Ridgway waved Cora on with his pistol. He would not be the first white man to see the Underground Railroad, but the first enemy. After all that had befallen her, the shame of betraying those who made possible her escape, she hesitated on the top step. On Randall, on Valentine, Cora never joined the dancing circles. She shrank from the spinning bodies, afraid of another person so close, so uncontrolled. Men had put a fear in her those years ago. Tonight, she told herself, tonight, I will hold him close, as if in a slow dance, as if it were just the two of them in the lonesome world, bound to each other until the end of the song. She waited until the slave catcher was on the third step. She spun and locked her arms around him like a chain of iron. The candle dropped. He attempted to keep his footing with her weight on him, reaching out for leverage against the wall, but she held him close like a lover, and the pair tumbled down the stone steps into the darkness. They fought and grappled in the violence of their fall. In the jumble of collisions, Cora's head knocked across the stone. Her leg was ripped one way, and her arm twisted under her at the bottom of the steps. Ridgway took the brunt. Homer yelped at the sounds his employer made as he fell. The boy descended slowly,
the lantern light shakily drawing the station from shadow. Cora untwined herself from Ridgeway and crawled toward the handcar, left leg in agony. The slave catcher didn't make a sound. She looked for a weapon and came up empty. Homer crouched next to his boss, his hand covered in blood from the back of Ridgeway's head. The big bone in the man's thigh stuck out of his trousers, and his other leg bent in a gruesome arrangement. Homer leaned his face in, and Ridgeway groaned.
Are you there, my boy?
Yes, sir.
That's good.
Ridgeway sat up and howled in anguish. He looked over the station's gloom, recognizing nothing. His gaze passed over Cora without interest.
Where are we?
On the hunt, Homer said.
Always more niggers to hunt. Do you have your journal?
Yes, sir.
I have a thought.
Homer removed his notes from the satchel and opened to a fresh page.
The imperative is... No, that's not it. The American imperative is a splendid thing. A beacon. A shining beacon.
He coughed, and a spasm overtook his body.
Born of necessity and virtue. Between the hammer and the anvil. Are you there, Homer?
Yes, sir.
Let me start again.
Cora leaned into the pump of the handcar. It didn't move, no matter how much weight she heaved on it. At her feet on the wooden platform was a small metal buckle. She snapped it, and the pump squeaked. She tried the lever again, and the handcar crawled forward. Cora looked back at Ridgeway and Homer. The slave catcher whispered his address, and the black boy recorded his words. She pumped and pumped and rolled out of the light, into the tunnel that no one had made, that led nowhere. She discovered a rhythm, pumping her arms, throwing all of herself into movement, into northness. Was she traveling through the tunnel or digging it? Each time she brought her arms down on the lever, she drove a pickaxe into the rock, swung a sledge onto a railroad spike. She never got Royal to tell her about the men and women who made the Underground Railroad. The ones who excavated a million tons of rock and dirt, toiled in the belly of the earth for the deliverance of slaves like her. Who stood with all those other souls who took runaways into their homes, fed them, carried them north on their backs, died for them. The station masters and conductors and sympathizers. Who are you after you finish something this magnificent? In constructing it, you have also journeyed through it, to the other side. On one end, there was who you were before you went underground, and on the other end, a new person steps out into the light. The up-top world must be so ordinary compared to the miracle beneath, the miracle you made with your sweat and blood, the secret triumph you keep in your heart. She put miles behind her, put behind her the counterfeit sanctuaries and endless chains, the murder of Valentine Farm. There was only the darkness of the tunnel, and somewhere ahead an exit, or a dead end, if that's what fate decreed. Nothing but a blank, pitiless wall. The last bitter joke. Finally spent, she curled on the handcar and dozed, aloft in the darkness, as if nestled in the deepest recess of the night sky. When she woke, she decided to go the rest of the way on foot. Her arms were empty, limping, tripping over cross ties. Cora ran her hand along the wall of the tunnel, the ridges and pockets, Her fingers danced over valleys, rivers, the peaks of mountains, the contours of a new nation hidden beneath the old. Look outside as you speed through and you'll find the true face of America. She could not see it, but she felt it, moved through its heart. She feared she'd gotten turned around in her sleep. Was she going deeper in or back from where she came? She trusted the slave's choice to guide her. Anywhere. Anywhere but where you are escaping from. It had gotten her this far. She'd find the terminus or die on the tracks. She slept twice more, dreaming of her and Royal in her cabin. She told him of her old life, and he held her, then turned her around so they faced each other. He pulled her dress over her head and took off his trousers and shirt. Cora kissed him and ran her hands over the territory of his body. When he spread her legs, she was wet, and he slid inside her, saying her name as no one had ever said it and as no one ever would, sugary and tender. She awoke each time to the void of the tunnel, and when she was done weeping over him, she stood and walked. The mouth of the tunnel started as a tiny hole in the dark. Her strides made it a circle, and then the mouth of a cave, hidden by brush and vines. She pushed aside the brambles and entered the air. It was warm. Still that stingy winter light, but warmer than Indiana, the sun almost overhead. The crevice burst open into a forest of scrub pine and fir. She didn't know what Michigan or Illinois or Canada looked like. Perhaps she wasn't in America anymore, but had pushed beyond it. She kneeled to drink from the creek when she stumbled on it. Cool, clear water. She washed the soot and grime from her arms and face. "From the mountains," she said, after an article in one of the dusty almanacs. Snow melt. Hunger made her head light. The sun told her which way was north. It was getting dark when she came upon the trail, worthless and pocked rut that it was. She heard the wagons after she'd been sitting on the rock a while. There were three of them, packed for a long journey, laden with gear, inventories lashed to the sides. They were headed west. The first driver was a tall white man with a straw hat, gray-whiskered and as impassive as a wall of rock. His wife sat beside him on the driver's box, pink face and neck poking out of a plaid blanket. They regarded her neutrally and passed on. Cora made no acknowledgement of their presence. A young man drove the second wagon, a red-headed fellow with Irish features. His blue eyes took her in. He stopped.
"You're a sight," he said,
high in pitch like a bird's chirping.
"You need something?"
Cora shook her head.
"I said, do you need anything?"
Cora shook her head again and rubbed her arms from the chill. The third wagon was commanded by an older Negro man. He was thick-set and grizzled, dressed in a heavy rancher's coat that had seen its share of labor. His eyes were kind, she decided, familiar, though she couldn't place it. The smoke from his pipe smelled like potatoes, and Cora's stomach made a noise.
"You hungry?" the man asked.
He was from the South, from his voice.
"I'm very hungry," Cora said. "Come up and take something for yourself," he said.
Cora clambered to the driver's box. He opened the basket. She tore off some bread and gobbled it down.
"There's plenty," he said.
He had a horseshoe brand on his neck and pulled up his collar to hide it when Cora's eyes lingered.
"Shall we catch up?"
"That's good," she said.
He barked at the horses and they proceeded on the rut.
Where you going? Cora said.
St. Louis. From there, the trail to California. Us and some people we gonna meet in Missouri.
When she didn't respond, he said,
You come from down south?
I was in Georgia. I ran away.
She said her name was Cora. She unfolded the blanket at her feet and wrapped herself in it.
I go by Ollie, he said.
The other two wagons came into view around the bend. The blanket was stiff and raspy under her chin, but she didn't mind. She wondered where he escaped from, how bad it was, and how far he traveled before he put it behind him. This is Bonnie Turpin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. This program was directed by Aaron Spencer, executive producer Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2016 by Colson Whitehead, production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.